I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Christina Rizga has been writing about schools for 10 years. She spent 4 years embedded in one of the nation's most diverse public schools, Mission High in San Francisco. It's also listed as among the lowest performing 5% of schools in the country. In her book, Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It and the Students and Teachers Who Made It Triumph, she follows four teachers and their remarkable students as they resisted pressure to focus on test scores and they struggled against closure. She asks some very important questions. What motivates students to learn, work hard, and persevere through life's toughest challenges? Why is it so difficult for the world's wealthiest and most powerful country to build good schools in every neighborhood? What's the best way to promote individual learning, critical thinking, intrinsic motivation, resilience, self-management, resourcefulness, and relationship skills? When it comes to educational reforms, Christina says we should listen to the voices of teachers and students. Christina will join us this hour to talk about her book, and we'll also be listening to the voice of one of the teachers who's really considered at the top of her game at the school. Perrette McCamey is a history teacher at Mission, and she is has found her 13-year-old students intellectually fascinating. In the book, she is described as the opposite of a teacher who runs among with predetermined notions. She's very clear about her teaching. She's completely present and responsive to students right from the beginning. She's done some very interesting units and has students engaged. And so she's a teacher worth listening to, as many are. We'll be welcoming phone calls for both our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, the Kathleen Dunn Show. Leave your messages. And we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, Christina. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's really great to be on your show.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. And I know that, thank you for sticking with this project because, as you said, getting inside a high school and really spending 4 years learning about it can be a very difficult endeavor.
Finding a school was difficult, but staying in it went by, felt like a month. It flew by. It was extremely fascinating, so that part wasn't difficult at all.
Yeah, but to get inside the school, it was difficult.
It was a little harder than I thought, but part of it was I started looking into a school that I could get into in September, and now having been at the school for 4 years, of course, I know it's the busiest, most intense time, lots of new students at the school, everyone's trying to figure out a schedule, and I reached out to a couple of principals in other schools and some teachers, and I couldn't get a response, but then by the time around October, I started looking at other schools in San Francisco, and principal got hers, got back to me. It's also important to note that when I was looking for a school to get into, this was, 2010, and this documentary, Waiting for Superman, just came out, and it was an extremely negative portrayal of teachers. It was essentially kind of blaming teachers for racial and economic disparities in our school, and so a lot of teachers were really wary of journalists. I think that was a big part of it.
I understand. You know, there has been so much, and you highlight so well, so much emphasis on test scores, and schools are judged by whether or not they're increasing those scores, and teachers are judged that way, and schools may close if the scores are not going up and up. And yet, when you look at the measure of what happens in the classroom and how students learn, what Mission is on paper in terms of test scores and what Mission is in terms of the number of students who are engaged and who are going on to college, two completely different stories.
Yes, I mean, I think it's important to note that, it's a work in progress. And one of the things that I wanted to highlight is that these crude labels that just label pretty much all of the schools that teach low-income students, Latino students, and African-American students, most of these schools are labeled as failing. And it's such a crude label based on one measure only. And what it does is, first of all, it doesn't allow us to find schools like Mission that are actually engaged in real work and real struggle to close the achievement gaps and have a lot to teach other urban schools that are going through similar struggles. The second thing that it does is it drives middle-class families, white and Asian American middle-class families, away from these schools, and we've seen segregation go up in our
yes.
schools in the last 10 years. And the third thing is that it forces so many of schools like Mission High School to focus on this one narrow measure when real learning really happens when you pay attention to what students do in the classroom every day, not just on how they perform on this multiple choice question.
Yeah. Tell this story through the eyes of one of the students, and her story is not atypical considering the makeup of the student body. The young girl, Maria, who comes to Mission from El Salvador, has had a very traumatic childhood. Tell us about her life and how she chose Mission and how it allowed her to really flourish.
Yeah, so Maria was actually... She was born and raised in El Salvador in a small village, and she was actually telling me that her school was, you know, one room for students of all ages, and no electricity, no running water. It was actually a struggle to attract teachers to that school, and the neighborhood also struggled with gang violence, and unfortunately her primary caregiver, her auntie, was brutally murdered by the gangs. And so she decided to join her mother, who had already been in the U.S. for 7 years. And when she got to San Francisco, you know, she said she talked to a lot of her friends and other parents, and they had a pretty negative perception of Mission, even though they'd never been to Mission. They'd heard bad things about it because it sort of had this label of a failing school. But then once she got to school, she said she talked to as many students as she could, and she couldn't find a single student who told her that it's a terrible school and that she should avoid. And she met a couple of teachers that she immediately felt that they were connected with her, that they were paying attention to her. And so even against the advice of her parents and her friends who had been to school, she decided to go to Mission. And by the time I met her, she was in the 10th grade, and she was actually one of the students who was very upset about that label, which I also found among some other students. You know, they were saying, how is it that, my teacher, Mr. Velez, and my teacher, Mr. Roth, they challenge me more than anyone, and I'm accepted to 5 colleges, and I'm succeeding, and so many of my friends are succeeding, and yet we're, always labeled as a failing school. She felt that it was unfair.
Mm-hmm. Well, she was taking the test. She did very, very well on writing, where she would get A+, the essay portions, but multiple choice, because there were words that still weren't very familiar to her. She didn't do well on multiple choice. No indication of how intelligent she was or how well she may do at college. It was based on A, B, C, D.
Yeah, exactly. It was a very narrow measure. And then, the other thing to keep in mind is it doesn't really measure the actual progress that she made. So, for example, when I observed her in Mr. Bellis's class, she went from kind of writing one paragraph to writing essays, and she often, the bell would ring and she would keep one of writing and writing. I watched her present an extremely sophisticated research, 10-page research paper on the war in Iraq in her ethnic studies class with Mr. Roth. And not only she wrote that paper, she presented it with poise and confidence. And yet, while not being proficient on these standardized tests, and even though she progressed, maybe by 3 grades as far as her writing is concerned, but as far as the state officials were concerned, well, she wasn't performing at the level of other 10th graders who, of course, are mostly middle class or more affluent students who have many more opportunities and advantages. And so as far as the state was concerned, it didn't matter that she made all this progress. She was not performing well on this narrow test, and so as a result, she was failing, her teachers were failing, and the school was failing.
Mm-hmm. One of the teachers highlighted, and you can't say enough about the importance of teachers, they're just crucial to how we learn and how excited we are about school. One of the teachers highlighted in Christina's book is Perrette McCamey. She's an award-winning social studies teacher. She's an English teacher. She actually covers many different disciplines because of the way that she teaches. And she's been closing achievement gaps in Central City schools for some 27 years. And we wanted to listen to her voice because, as Christina says, she listened to the voices of teachers and students. And when we're looking at educational reform, those are probably the voices that we should be listening to. Perrette, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. I would love to have been in your classroom. You create all these interesting units, don't you, that are multidisciplinary, and students will learn about a subject for a six-week lesson plan around a central theme. You really get them intellectually challenged and very engaged.
Unit planning is very exciting because you're taking a complex idea or concept or written work and trying to make it three-dimensional and understandable and relevant. So that's one of my favorite things to do is plan units. With my class right now, 12th grade English students, we're just finishing up a unit around poetry analysis.
Mm.
Yeah. And we just had a really great day today. And by great, I mean that the students were able to clearly express what they know and what they're able to do. It was quite exciting.
Oh, I would imagine. And the fact that you can say that and you've been teaching for 27 years says that you're in the right profession, Perrette. How do you find time to do that kind of teaching when, as everybody knows, there is a huge emphasis on testing now? And from what I understand, many classrooms and many teachers simply having to devote huge chunks of time getting students prepared for the many tests they have to take.
I would say that, you know, the Common Core is what we're concentrating on at the moment. And in my 27 years as a teacher, we've concentrated on lots of different tests. And Mission High School is very interesting in that they make the test integrate into the school as opposed to the school integrating into the test.
Mm.
So we look at the test closely in terms of the skills the students need to know in order to do well on the test, the skills and the content, and then we match it with the curriculum. How can it be highlighted or added or highlighted or added into the curriculum? So, in other words, we don't ignore the test, but also we don't make it the center of what we're doing. Student achievement is the center of what we're doing, of course.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to get back to you. First, I'm going to ask Christina the same question, but I'm wondering what is the best way to determine how well individuals are learning and how they develop all those components that are important in life that you list, Christina: critical thinking, intrinsic motivation, resilience, self-management, resourcefulness, and relationship skills. What is the best way for a school to be able to give that to students?
I think that, you know, I'm sure Perrette has a lot more to add to that. But I would say what was really fascinating to me is to watch how at Mission High School a lot of teachers try to teach these skills through a variety of formats, right? So there's going to be an incredibly rich and intellectually engaging content. There will be opportunities for students to talk about the content with each other, opportunities to work in groups, opportunities to practice skills different. There's always writing and essays. There's a little bit of discussion. There's longer research projects. There's presentation. So, in other words, what you see at Mission High School very much mimics sort of what happens in life and the workplace and in college. It's not designed around, a narrow standard or a narrow Common Core test. They're still primarily multiple choice tests. It's not designed around that. It's designed around real skills that students need in college and life. And it's also designed around their interests and their experiences. So one of the most amazing things for me was to watch how much time teachers like For at McCamey's, been paying attention to how students are experiencing her classroom, not just at the end of the classroom, but throughout the classroom. You know, experienced veteran teachers like Ms. McCamey will switch things up through the class, in the middle of the class. You know, one time we were reading, an article, we were engaging with a novel, The Things They Carry, Tim O'Brien's novel, mm-hmm. and they were reading an article about the Vietnam War, and they just weren't that interested in it at the time. And Fred just switched up activities and did a little creative writing assignment, and it just completely changed the energy in the classroom. And students were writing and learning skills while writing poetry, and the engagement was up, and the energy was popping. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of what veteran, they're constantly paying attention to how students are responding. They're looking at student work to see if they're learning the content and the skills, and they're constantly iterating and adjusting and mm-hmm. teaching a broad range of skills.
Perrette, I know that you're a firm believer in writing, students doing a lot of writing, right?
Yes.
Why?
Well, you know, I've read a lot of Noam Chomsky and Steven Pinker, and they talk about writing as allowing people to think in a different way than you would do when you speak or when you just think or when you engage in conversation with another person. Writing allows you to think about things more deeply because you encounter your own thinking when you do that. So you present problems of logic that you untie yourself. So in other words, when students are writing, I feel as though I can see their brains growing, you know? And then also they can visit it later. And so they write and they think, and they think about it, you know, subconsciously or directly over time. And then when they revisit it, they have more to add to it. So it's just, it's like a living, the living thinking process.
Hmm. And what do you do? Many of the students, we were talking about Maria earlier in the hour, coming from El Salvador, obviously English is not the language that she speaks, and it, she's not quite up to speed as somebody who was born in America and spoke English all the time would be. So there are phrases and probably grammar that's not entirely correct. Do you think that getting the ideas down is more important than making sure it's structured the way that it should be? And are we tested more on the structure of something rather than what we say?
I think both things are quite important because we are judged by both things in the world. So, for example, while I'm teaching them and leading them through the analysis of The Second Coming by William Butler Yeats, so they're practicing thinking and looking closely at words and thoughts and taking a poem on its own terms and trying to determine what the author intended to say by looking closely at words, I care, obviously, a great deal about their thinking, but also they have to communicate that in a educational, formal, correct way. So it's about, as opposed to looking at them from a deficit model, this is what you can't do, it's saying you're struggling to say this about the content, and here are the tools you need in order to say that. So working with complex sentence structures, for example, adjective clauses, perhaps, or simple things like subject-verb agreement in the first person or third person, really, is when it happens, the problems. It's offering that instruction when the student has a genuine interest in it because they're trying to communicate something that is commensurate with their age level and their intellectual sophistication. So they're almost begging for it, so they learn it quickly.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests, and we'll do so in just one moment. We're speaking with the author of Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It, and the Students and Teachers Who Made It Triumph. Mission High is located in San Francisco, and it was deemed to be in the lowest performing 5% of schools in the country. But if you enter the school and spend 4 years there reporting on it, as Christina has, you find something else. You find a school where students say they love being. The teachers, many of them are extremely energetic and putting together creative and challenging curricula for the students. And there's a lot of learning going on. So are we measuring learning in some way that isn't quite accurate? Is there another way to measure learning? And are we saying some schools are low performing and may close them when it shouldn't be happening? How do we measure student learning? And what about listening to students and teachers as we undergo this rapid educational reform? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. So we'll be with you momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we have two guests with us this hour. Christina Rizka covers education for Mother Jones, and she is the author of Mission High. Perrette McKamey teaches at Mission. She's an award-winning history teacher and English teacher who's been closing achievement gaps in Central City schools for 27 years now, and as you can hear, introduces her students to thought-provoking and challenging pieces of literature and has a classroom that changes direction to get students engaged at a moment's notice. We're certainly welcoming phone calls. As we look at education reform, are there too many of you in the education profession who have to teach to tests? Should we be measuring schools in a different way? 800-486-8655 is our number, and feel free to join us. We would like very much to hear from you. I'd like to hear from both of you, Christina and Perrette. You talk about how important it is to listen, Christina, to teachers on this subject when it comes to education reform and to students as well. Are we doing that? It seems to me as though they've been excluded, and they certainly are a vital part of the conversation.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it really gets at the main reason behind why I wanted to write this book. As an education reporter, I noticed that we rarely heard from teachers and students. You know, there was a 2014 Media Matters study that found that whenever we discussed education reform on TV, only 9% of contributors were actual teachers. So thank you, Kathleen, for closing this gap. And, of course, the people who dominate our conversations around education reforms, these are the experts in my book. And, you know, these are politicians, economists, and big philanthropists like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg. And they dominate our conversation around what it takes to improve schools and inform sort of the prevailing ideology around how you do that. And they come from business and tech companies, and so they talk about what they know about. They talk about organizational restructuring, right, that informed the school improvement grant initiative. So, you know, closing schools, replacing them with charter, firing staff. It's all about kind of management and restructuring, whereas what I found after 4 years at Mission High School, talking to students and teachers, that it has to do with learning and teaching, and it has to do with things that these experts mostly know very little about.
Mm-hmm. Perrette, when somebody asks you, as I will now, what works in terms of educational reform, how do you answer?
I would say that the most important thing is to give teachers the time to reflect on their practice and get better with leadership, being led by people who have shown success with the students with whom they're charged. That's what I'd say. The biggest thing is teacher practice and creating systems within a school that allow teachers to get better at their practice.
Mm-hmm. Let me have you respond to Linda's message on Facebook. As a teacher, she says, the measuring tools, all the testing, takes many, many days away from teaching. Just let us teach. Teachers are dedicated to their students.
So I agree. But I do want to add that there has to be some measure of student learning. And, I mean, we want the students to learn. We want to make sure they're learning. But the question is, what are the measures that accurately paint the picture of what's happening for students in their learning? And Christina was talking about, she was mentioning lots of different things that go on in a classroom. And at Mission, we try to look at the student work a lot to determine if the students are learning or not. And that's the central thing. Can they do this thing? Can they write this essay? Can they do this math? And they can or they can't. in a kind of blunt or gross way. That's the question, can they or can't they? But the most important part about that is if they didn't fully do it, in what way didn't they do it? What didn't they understand? And because it's a reciprocal information, it goes back to the teacher. And if they didn't understand that, what didn't I do in an efficacious way? What can I do better?
Let's go to some phone calls. Richard in Madison. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Well, hi. I appreciate very much your efforts. I was an English teacher myself until I retired. And I'm going to tell you something, in Wisconsin at least. There is a push by the American Legislative Executive Council. It's a think tank. Which sponsors the American Federation for Children. And their goal is to keep on testing until all schools break and all public money that goes to education, public schools, will be going to private schools.
Christina.
Yeah, there's, you know, I think there's definitely elements. I think the education reform movement is a very complex movement, and there's all kinds of different people, you know, ranging from civil rights groups, there are a lot of D.C.-based civil rights groups. But then there's also, of course, there's, for example, the Walton Foundation, you know, the Walmart Family Foundation. They support vouchers, and they're pretty open about the fact that they think that private schools will deliver better education than public schools, and they're doing a lot to divert a lot of our resources there. But then within the movement, there's also folks who work in charter schools, and some of them are started and run by teachers of color. You know, who worked in large districts that didn't serve the needs of students of color. So it's very complicated. I think that it would be unfair to say that everyone in the education reform movement wants to privatize education, although that limit is there. I think what's important, though, what's significant, is that the prevailing ideology is it's extremely top-down. It's driven by predominantly white elites. And they're focusing on 843 urban schools, urban rural schools that serve predominantly communities of color. And they're they're hiring expensive consultants that, you know, in some cities like Newark cost $1,000 a day. They use taxpayer money to hire these consultants, and they design, you know, all sorts of restructuring and management, reforms that are essentially a waste of taxpayer money. It's extremely disruptive to communities of color, and it completely dismisses the voices of parents and students on the ground. I think that's the most significant part to kind of keep in mind, that this is the part that makes it, you know, this disruptive and distracting, and it displaces a lot of students and communities.
Perrette, do you think that there's a growing lack of support for public education and a move to really dramatically change the way we educate young people in this country?
I think there might be. There are enough policies that come down the pike that I always ask myself, as a country, how committed we are to public education. I do have a question about that. I mean, there's so many things, so many policies that are implemented that don't make sense. So we'll start one policy and things will improve in a classroom. Things will improve in schools. By all measures, students will be learning more. And then that policy will shift with the next political shift at the local or, you know, government level, national level. So I know there's a lot of dollars floating around and that education is big business. So, yeah, I ask myself that a lot.
Thank you very much, Richard, for your call. Lynn in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, Kathleen, and good afternoon to your guests. I'm 60, which is, you know, it lets you know when I was in high school. I won a full scholarship that I denied. I didn't want it. I didn't want to go. It wasn't for me. I wanted to be a housewife and mother, and I've done it successfully for 40 years. And I was given, I think we need to maybe redefine success. And I was given I had wonderful teachers. I had a parochial grade school education and a public high school education. And so, I learned everything I needed to know to make it into college, but also to deny the scholarship and make it in life. And maybe things were simpler, maybe I'm naive, but success is more than dollars.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. How do you determine if a student has had a successful time at Mission High School? Christina?
Well, I think the most, you know, first of all, we should ask, we should give the agency to the student and the parent to be a part of that conversation, right? And I think that it will look really different depending on the person that you ask. I meet a lot of parents who think that success on standardized test scores is the most important thing. They tell me, look, you know, SATs and ACTs are multiple choice standardized tests, and I really want that to be the emphasis. And then I meet a lot of other parents, and it's, you know, spans class and race, and they'll say, I want my child to be challenged intellectually in a variety of ways. I don't really care that whether, you know, they get into Harvard. I want them to go to a college that will suit them, that will engage their intellect, and they'll be able to pursue their interests and passions. And so I'm going to look at a variety of things. I'm going to look at, you know, do they teach writing? Do they pay attention to what students are interested in? Do they provide opportunities for the student to present the material or, you know, participate in challenging science investigations? Or do they have after-school programs? Do students have, you know, access to a rich and broad variety of honors and AP classes? So I think it sort of gets at the heart of why we are having so many disagreements, is because, ultimately a lot of parents and students define success in different ways, as it should be. Mm-hmm. What's not working is that communities are not really, you know, what communities want is really overlooked. And there's, a very narrow definition of success, which is essentially, you know, standardized test scores or, graduation rates. And then we sort of design everything around that versus the actual interest and desires of students and parents.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the makeup of the classroom. Perrette, tell me about the students that are in your classroom every day. How many of them are facing problems like Maria with a language that isn't her primary language? How many students have a lot of issues? Not that everybody doesn't have issues, but have some fairly dramatic issues going on when they go home.
I can't exactly speak to the dramatic issues when they go home, but I have at least, I would say, 30% of my students or 40% of my students are language learners.
Ooh, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. English was not their first language. I'd say that in terms of the classroom, that's the biggest thing that I have to pay attention to in terms of planning curriculum, delivering curriculum, to make everyone successful. That's the biggest.
In terms of finding material, and I know you do some of this, that will be more relevant to them, that will make them more excited about learning something, or in terms of the words that they have to be, there might be a lot of words that would be unfamiliar to them.
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's I read a lot by the education writer and researcher Claude Steele, and he writes about making things in the classroom very rigorous so that then it's the teacher's job to provide the bridge for all the students to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the opposite of remediation. And so if I have an article, for example, that's very difficult to read in terms of its content and density and vocabulary, and it's hard for everyone, then I have to figure out ways to make it accessible to all my students. So that's the approach I try to take, if you see what I'm saying.
Yes. And when you, do you have to take into account a student like Maria, who's had this violence in her life and made a long journey to come to the United States to be with her mom, do you take people's stories like that? Do they find their way into the classroom in some way?
The thing that I want to say, first of all, is that it's a part of I call things like my background or my backstory. And so it helps me to figure out what affect to have in the classroom.
Yes.
You know, to work on my patience and to work on softening of my tone when I feel quite, I feel urgent about things.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's my backstory, to remember that I don't know what people have been through. And so I remember to treat them with compassion and treat them as a whole person, not just about getting my content or not. So that's how it is, a backstory.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the rest of the question, actually.
So do I. I think you covered. I think you covered all of it, though.
Good.
Yeah. Christine, you want to respond to that too, because there are all kinds of stories in every school.
Well, I think that one of the things I learned, which was really helpful for me, from Perrette McKamey and Robert Roth and Taika Hsu, is that there is this thing where I think a lot of times teachers focus a little bit too much on the personal personal background, and this is what it's called, sort of the deficit model, right? When we talk about students of color like Maria, in the national discourse, when journalists or even sometimes many teachers discuss her, they focus on the violence and the one room with the mud floors and no water and electricity, and we overlook the fact that this is incredibly brilliant student who wants to be seen as an intellectual in the classroom.
Sure.
Who can write complex sentences and write and teach everyone in her classroom about the war in El Salvador and the war in Iraq and make connections between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, these personal stories come up, I think, in the classrooms of effective teachers after class or in the paper or in an essay, but that doesn't dominate the way they look at their students at Mission High School. The most important thing is, did Maria engage with the content? Did she progress in her skills? And did she have opportunities to practice her skills and express her voice at the same time? I think, it's a little bit actually concerning right now to me. I'm hearing a lot of, there's a lot of research that shows that, of course, childhood trauma and violence in the communities or a family affects a student's ability to learn. But in the last 2 years, it's sort of become this main emphasis when we talk about African-American and Latino students.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like sort of, it just dominates. And we miss, I think, the more important part, that these students are extremely brilliant and resilient and also have a lot to teach to other students. And that's really why I wanted to dedicate so much time to their stories, because I think that if you read Maria's story, certainly it's all there, but it's not what, teachers focus on. And it also doesn't mean that she doesn't have a lot to contribute to, not only, teaching other students, but also teaching us how to, reform classrooms.
Right.
and what it makes to create a good school.
Yeah. You mentioned that some of your friends wouldn't even think of sending their children to public schools in San Francisco and certainly wouldn't think of going to Mission High. What responsibility, why is that so common, that many people who are a little more affluent figure they have
mm-hmm.
to do private schools or they've got
right.
They won't support? And how would it change Mission if you had people from, wealthy people and a lot more, Caucasian people and a real mixture of students instead of a lot of students
mm-hmm.
who don't speak English very well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad. It relates to your previous question, I think, is because, right, I think that my, a a lot of my friends read stories about trauma and violence and things like that. And this other side of human beings is completely overlooked. And, you know, when I at first was telling a lot of my, you know, white middle class friends that I was spending a lot of time at Mission, you know, they assumed that there's metal detectors and there's just, you know, constant fights and drugs and gangs and but that there isn't, you know, intellectual discourse and real learning happening. And that also I spent 4 years there and felt, you know, completely safe at every moment and learned so much about myself and the world. So it's, you know, it goes hand in hand. It's sort of how we talk about these students and how we treat them, and also, of course, these larger labels, right, that these schools are failing based on a very narrow measure. And I think that, but it's slowly changing. There's now 13%, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think 13% this year of students are white students. There's more Asian American schools. It's a very integrated school. And what's interesting to me is that you know, a lot of some students have told me that they're a little bit worried about how the school will change because, you know, on the one hand, we know that when schools integrate, you know, when white and middle-class families come to schools, more resources follow.
Right.
You know, taxpayer money goes more to rich schools than schools serving low-income students. Mm-hmm. That's a huge injustice. But so that happens. But at the same time, at a certain point, these schools in many communities change and they start serving primarily middle-class students, you know, a lot of students with the greatest needs become displaced. So it's a complicated process, and, you know, it's important to kind of do it right in a way that's equitable and doesn't displace the communities that Mission High School is serving right
mm-hmm.
now.
What do you say to that, Perret?
What do I say to all that? Well, I'm sorry, but I have nothing to add to that.
So you agree with what Christina said?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. We welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. The author of Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It, and the Students and Teachers Who Made It Triumph. The author is William Rizga. She's been writing about schools for 10 years and spent 4 years, as I said, inside this school, getting to know a lot of students and getting to know about teachers. And one of the overriding themes of the book is, what is the best way to monitor and promote individual learning? Is there too much emphasis on standardized test scores to show that schools are good? What do you think? What do you, the audience, think? More calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls. Philothea in Viroqua. Hi.
Hi, it's Philothea. I'm so glad to be able to talk to you. This has been a wonderful show.
Great.
And I have actually made it to the point where I've taught for 50 years.
50 years?
Oh, 50 years? I don't feel that old. But I've been in a lot of schools, private and public, and I've been involved in the Waldorf school, and I've been involved in a parochial school. And I just wanted to kind of reiterate what I think is really makes a good school, and I think it's really centrally the teachers. And so you have to have good teachers, and you have to give them a good morale in the school. And I felt in Wisconsin the last few years that I know a lot of teachers whose morale is very low right now, and they seem to be being undermined in every way. But you really want, if you make an environment for teachers where they love to teach and they are free to create and they're free to work with their students, it is such a different environment and everyone will love to go to school. And one of the things that I had in my very first year of teaching was a mentor, and one of your guests mentioned this at the very beginning. Every new teacher was given a teacher mentor from a, you know, really good master teacher. We were taped, videotaped, and we had many discussions, and we were observed, and really helped. And they said, we advance our new teachers by 10 years by just doing this with them. And also at that first school, we were encouraged to cooperate with each other. And I do think there's sometimes competition between teachers, often in the elementary grades, sort of, you know, every egotistical person is behind the walls in their classroom. But if you can have teachers really helping each other to be better teachers, that's a wonderful mm-hmm. environment. So I just wanted to mention that, and I just think what's been said today has been really great. And
Thanks, Phil, for being with us. And I know you do this, Perrette, that you've teamed up with another teacher to, and that must be a joy to be able to work that way, to create really interesting study programs for students. It builds enthusiasm. You can bounce ideas off each other. You can create something that maybe one of you wouldn't have created, but two of you can.
I just want to say that I really appreciate the caller's comments, and you can hear, in terms of the synthesis of all her experience and ideas, you can hear the 50 years of experience. And that people who've been teaching for a long time, we draw the same conclusions, that teachers need respect, and the time to cooperate with each other, and the tools and the skills to get the job done, and that builds morale. And so I really appreciate it. At Mission High School, a few teachers, myself included, have time off. It's built into the schedule. It's built into the budget to coach teachers. And so I sit in classrooms with teachers and observe them and work with them, and then work with them on their curriculum, their delivery. It's an ongoing process. Sometimes it lasts for a few teachers. It's lasted for 3 years. So it's very intense and very rewarding and fun, I'd say.
And very important, and maybe rare, Christina, is it?
It is. Sadly, that is what I found through my research and reporting from other schools. You know, in the United States, teachers in a typical school in the U.S. get about 3 to 5 hours a week to do that kind of work. And in other countries, in other high-performing countries like Finland and South Korea and Singapore, teachers get anywhere between 15 to 25 paid hours every week to do that kind of work, to collaborate, to pore over student work together, to observe each other, and be coached and receive support. On top of it, what makes it even more difficult is teachers in the United States have heavier teaching loads than teachers in almost any other industrialized country. So all of that structurally makes it very, very difficult to find the time, the kind of time that Perrette was describing. And what's really upsetting to me, having done this research and reporting, is that so much of our funding, taxpayer funding, is going to support outside consultants, very expensive outside consultants who kind of deliver prepackaged curriculum or
yes.
prepackaged tests
mm-hmm.
or, sit there and, create ever more complicated teacher evaluation forms or ever more complicated accountability systems. Meanwhile, this most important part, the capacity of teachers to learn and lead on the job, is overlooked in the United States more than most other industrialized countries. And that's, one of the main reasons why I wanted to illustrate this work on the ground and hopefully help, shift some of these priorities.
Mm-hmm. Perrette, are you going to teach for 50 years?
Yeah. Highly unlikely.
That is one long time,
that's a
isn't
long
it?
Time. I think I started too late.
Well, I have a feeling you'll be at it for quite some time. Thank you
I
both.
Hope so.
Yeah, thank you both so much for being with us. Christina, thanks for the book. I hope it's read by many. It's an important contribution to education reform, right? To real
Thank
reform.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you
for having teachers on your show and for helping us get the word out.
Oh, our pleasure. Our guest, Christina Rizga, and the book is Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It, and the Students and Teachers Who Made It Triumph. And one of those teachers also with us, she's been teaching for some 27 years, Perrette McCamey. She teaches history and English and does some really interesting units for her students at Mission High in San Francisco. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to Scott T. Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll be with you again on Monday, another edition of All Things Political, which always happens on Mondays, and they've been interesting in this presidential campaign cycle. Our guest, Matt Visor, national political reporter for the Boston Globe. So that's coming up Monday for All Things Political. News from National Public Radio on the air in just one moment, so stay tuned for that, and thanks for listening to the show today on the Ideas Network.